Welcome to the Carpcast. Introducing the two biggest nods that don't use jobs. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 8, I think we're on now, of the Carpcast. How are you doing, Mark?
Oh, not bad, yes, number 8. I'm enjoying this, I'm loving this, to be honest. Life's good at the minute.
Yeah, it's good, lots of interest. I think we've officially hit the 10,000 download mark. We were just short of 5,000 for May alone. And I think we can comfortably hit 5,000 a month now, which is probably similar to most magazines, so... maybe we'll start selling advertising soon or something, I don't know, to keep this going.
I think that hint was as subtle as a brick, but I totally agree with you.
Anybody wishes to advertise on the Carpcast, you are more than welcome to get in touch. Probably find it's considerably cheaper than other areas you can advertise in, and we hopefully have a captive audience for 2 hours, and if we actually can get some sort of money going with this, then we can make them more regular. I know the hardcore monks, you probably don't want to listen to me make an advert or talk about a product, but if it means that 2 hours of your favorite podcasting happens more regular, then it's something that maybe you can live with. I don't know. But we will endeavour to go down that route, I think, if anyone wants to get in touch. While we're whoring ourselves out, then I must point you to the Amazon link under the podcast. You can, if you're going to buy something off Amazon, birthday present for the folks or for the missus, other half, then use our link. And that'll give us about 3 pence. I think, did we make 3 quid since the last show?
I think it's just over 3 quid, yeah. But every little helps, as they say. Was it Tesco?
Yes. We don't get anything, so don't buy anything from there because we get no commission on Tesco goods. Other supermarkets are available. But, yeah, if you use our Amazon link, which is in the blurb for the podcast underneath, if you're going to buy something. I need to buy a couple of things, actually. They do some decent charges for you know, like little charging packs, lithium charging packs for your phone. I've already got 2, which gets me through a 4-day session really of tanning Facebook all day long and watching videos and TV on the phone. And you get about 4 charges off each thing. They're 15 quid, little black power pack. But a pal of mine wants one, so I said I'd order it for him on that, using our Amazon link, so that'll probably get us another penny maybe. Something
well, like that. I don't know. I think we could hope for at least 3 pence off that one.
Jacking off a 15 quid sale. I don't know how it works, but we've made 3 quid, so we're happy.
Yeah, there's different rates for different products, but it all helps. So get on the link and buy. It will cost you no more than it would usually.
And seamlessly linking from Amazon, being a net-based company, what have you seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
This is one we've mentioned before, and I know you're interested in it, so I've put it in. Abbey Lake Shoulders, it's out £97 now.
Wow, it's not long before that one hits 100, I don't think. A guy called Wayne Langford has caught it. We spoke about Abbey before. I fancy a winter ticket 1 year. Don't know if it's ever going to happen or if I would ever get there. But obviously, if you do go and fish Abbey, that is the king of the castle, that one, isn't it? Shoulders, what a chunk.
Yeah, certainly, you wouldn't shake it off. It's like the big brother of the big one in Willers that we've spoke about before as well.
Yeah, it's a cracking looking fish, big set of shoulders on it, hence its name. And any £90 plus carp, there's a few around now. I mean, it's just what a feat to hold a fish that big.
Yeah, do you think it could overtake the Euro Aqua, or is it will always be playing catch up?
No, I don't think they're getting fed. I don't think the fisher is young, and I don't think they're getting fed like the Euro Aqua fish. They're very young, those Euro Aqua fish, and they're getting like tons, literally tons of feed every week. So I can't see anything stopping or coming close to the Euro Aqua ones. I mean, it's already £7 bigger and. Like now, and I'm guessing that gap will widen every year.
Yeah, but if you look at £7, that's less than 10% of its body weight.
Yeah,
We know how fish that size, through our own experiences, like to the fat lady, how they can go up and down and fluctuate.
Yeah, but I think there'll be half a dozen fish out of Euro at credit break the £100 mark this year. You know, certainly by Christmas, I bet we're looking at 500 pounders out there, just at the rate they're growing and how they're getting fed.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever see a Euro Acra fish get to £100 and then explode?
Possibly. Spontaneously combust.
Yeah, there'll be fish guts and maize and boilies all over the place.
I'll tell you what else I saw on the net.
It's on the net. It must be true.
The spooky picture of the angler that it's like a, I don't know if it's a mark in the tree, but it's a night picture. A guy called Wayne, he's holding a 16-pound carp, and there's like a ghostly face in the tree behind him, isn't there?
There is, yeah, I've seen that one, and it did make me chuckle. It is, in all likeliness, just a shadow of some lights in the background. Well, it's been picked up by a national newspaper.
Yeah, it was in the Daily Mail, wasn't it? They like to do fishing stuff from time to time. And apparently there have been a couple of suicides in that water, so it does have a grim past.
Yeah, it just it adds to the spookiness. Have you ever seen a ghost or had anything give you the willies whilst fishing?
No, but if I was a ghost, like, why would you just kind of, like, rattle plates on the sideboard or, you know, just creak doors every now and again? Like, could you not think of a better things to do when you're a ghost?
If I was a ghost, I'd be sat in the corner in a room in the Playboy Mansion, quite happy.
Yeah, big ghoulish perv face.
Oh, I'll be grinning from ear to ear.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, I can think of better things to do when you're a ghost than just like. Just like rattle stuff, make noises and spook people. Sure, there's better stuff.
It's on the net. It must be true.
This is one thing I noticed. It's a story that seems to pop up every now and then. This comes from Nutribake's Facebook page. Warning of dodgy bait rollers supplying bait that not is what it claims to be. Which, on this occasion, it's their blue oyster bait. There's actually pictures of the original bait. And a bland-looking, probably a cut copy that a rolling company, they don't name them unfortunately, is selling as the real thing, and it just ain't.
So I'm guessing what's happening then is these rolling companies are buying the base mix from Nutribaits or some alleged dodgy bait rollers are buying base mix and then just basically cutting it, weakening the base mix and maybe substituting it with something that's cheaper and turning it into more, I would assume, much in the way a drug dealer works. or it's happened with people do it with spirits, don't they? I've heard of not so scrupulous licensees and stuff watering down vodka and stuff like that. You know, I mean, considering if you get anything that's expensive, you know, that people want and cost money, and you give them the opportunity, then, you know, unscrupulous people are going to do that, whether it be a licensee, a boiler maker or a drug dealer. So I can only assume, though, I mean, it's down to the company selling the base mix that's the one that's responsible for it. How would a consumer know the exact... If he just rings up a company he sees in a magazine or online or something and says, yeah, I want to order some of this, you know, Nash bait, or Nutribaits or any single bait company says, I want to order that thing, you expect that you're getting the real thing. Surely it's for the bait company who is selling this mix. They're the one that own the name of the product. They're the one that people are going to think, you know, this bait's no good if it's, you know, an inferior copy. Surely it's down to them to make sure there's no inferior copies of their bait about.
Yeah, I see your point there, but if you're in a bar and you get a pint of Stella and it tastes like crap, do you blame Stella or the bar? You just don't go back to that bar, do you?
Yeah, that's the point. But, I mean, how do they know any different unless, you know, they don't catch on it? I mean, if Nutribaits have got a deal with a number of bait rolling companies, presumably they sell this base mix to the company, surely it's down to them to check. As, you know, Stella... do you know they have reps that go out being a licensee myself, having owned a bar, you know, they, all the companies have their reps that come out. They make sure your bottles are on the shelf. You've got trading standards that come and test the percentage of alcohol in your spirits to make sure, you know, there's loads of precautions there to, obviously stuff slips through the nets. You know, if somebody loads all their stuff up on a busy Friday night and sells, you know, watered down booze over the weekend, then, and you don't get inspected, then, you know, it can get through. Yes, the customers know. I mean, I know people that serially complain about the vodka's rubbish in here, it's watered down, and I don't know how many people actually do it. We clearly didn't, but surely it's down to Nutrabates to be checking. You know, I'd be having somebody buying 10k off them just to make sure that it's what I've sold them coming back to me.
That may be what has happened. They found someone, they put it on the Facebook warning people.
Yep, and I'm presuming they are not going to sell this base mix anymore to said company.
No, I wouldn't. There may even be legal action possible, I'm sure, but who knows?
Is it any good, that Blue Oyster? I've not heard of it. Blue Oyster from Nutrabates. Send us some money.
Yeah, where else have you heard Blue Oyster?
Blue Oyster Cult.
No, do you remember, was it Blue Oyster Bar? Police Academy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not that old. I can't remember.
You're older than me.
It's on the net. It must be true.
This is what I've seen, which confused me a touch. This is two different people, different situations, both slagging off EA bailiffs on Facebook and one on Twitter, basically saying they are like traffic wardens when these people are basically doing their job. If you don't buy a license, then you deserve to get caught.
Traffic wardens are just doing their job, aren't they?
Yeah. Well, I used to be a taxi driver, and I've got my own thing with traffic wardens, especially the ones around Doncaster. One in particular. But anyway,
I'm playing devil's advocate. I'm not a fan of traffic wardens. It should be said now. There's certain types of people that do certain jobs because they like being in control or bossing people about. I'm sure there's some really nice traffic wardens out there that just do it because they needed a job and it came up. But there are also other traffic wardens that they have no benefit of the doubt. You know, I have had dozens and dozens and dozens of tickets over the year. You know, I've had 15 outstanding at one time. On a number of occasions in my life, owning a bar in the centre of Blackpool. You know, sometimes I went in to collect the takings on a Sunday night at 10 p.m. on a Sunday night. I pull up outside the bar for literally 60 seconds and they're putting a ticket on the car. 10 o'clock on a Sunday night. You know, I've had many, many run-ins with traffic wardens, and a couple of them are cool. You know, you say to them, look, you know, run the business, just trying to make a living like you are, and, you know, they're cool. They let you go. And there's others, they take delight in dishing the ticket out. I've diversed into traffic wardens, but the point is, you don't join the EA just to go check in licenses. They probably go out three or four times a year on the particular day that EA bailiffs go and check licenses. They have to be sworn in by a judge so that they can issue you your rights, basically, because it's a criminal offence not to have a rod license. So I know that they have a police radio on that particular day, and it's quite a big deal for them to actually go out checking, which is why maybe we don't see them as often as some people do. But that bit of checking your licenses is a chore to them. I don't think they want to do that bit of the job. You know, it's probably less than 0.5% of their yearly duties to go out checking licenses. The licenses cover all sorts of damage on every bit of waterway in this country, from canals, locks. Some people aren't aware that if you dig a lake in your back garden, you don't actually own the water in it. The EA do. The EA own every bit of water in this country. That's their job. And if something goes wrong, something gets polluted, or legal action needs to be taken, or dozens and dozens of other things, they're the people that you ring. You know, they're in it because I can't say why everybody joins the EA, but they certainly don't do it to go around getting on your case as an angler because you've bought one license and you're fishing three rods. Just part of the job to make sure that the money's collecting in to keep the whole system going round. So to compare them to traffic wardens, it's a joke, I think.
Yeah, I've got to agree with you. And, you know, we may not all agree with a lot of stuff the Environment Agency do or where the money goes or allegedly doesn't go, but it's the law. They're not mega expensive. Was it 27 quid times two for us carpers?
Well, it's the government that collect it's the government that collect the licence fee, and it's the government that make it a criminal offence, not the EA. The EA are just a government body that are out there managing the water in the country. I don't know. I've known a few EA bailiffs over the years, and we have the EA at the Northern Angling Show. They come and represent, and I think they do a great job. You know, they are government funded. They do it on limited funds. They're tied to what they can and can't do a lot of the time. And, you know, I know they're also having meetings about sorting the three rod issue out as well for carp anglers. You know, people having to pay for four rods when you can't use four rods on most lakes. Most lakes is a three rod rule, and you have to buy two licenses for four rod. I totally understand people having an issue with that, and I believe it's not going to be too long before we see a three rod license out. There'll be a one, a two, and a three. I read it somewhere recently, actually. I should have marked it down for on the net, but I have read something that there was a meeting or some sort of discussion, and I even saw prices mentioned for the 1, 2 and 3 rod, 1, 2, 3 and 4 rod licence, which would make more sense. But like you say, I mean, I'm not necessarily sure I understand why you need a licence to own a fishing rod. I'm not really sure why the government decided to tax that somewhere along the way, but the government did decide that the people responsible for making sure these rod licences are paid are the EA rather than the police. But it's a police matter once the EA catch you. So it's a bit of a confusing system. It's red tape, but I'm pretty sure that the people that go and work for the EA are not there just to catch out anglers or to rinse anglers or whatever. You know, they're not plastic policemen or, you know, people that just want to be in a position of power. They're there because, you know, they're working with water, outside, nature, whatever. It's completely the opposite of why some traffic wardens like to become traffic wardens.
Do you think they have really small knobs? They've got to compensate somewhere by wandering around and dishing tickets out. It makes them feel better inside.
It's on the net. It must be true.
It's official. As of 4th of June 2015, Fishing Republic will consolidate its position as the UK's number one fishing tackle company by becoming the first UK fishing tackle company to float on the stock market. You work for them, don't you?
I do, yes. And remember back on Carpcast 1, I believe, we mentioned Les's Aluton folding.
Yep.
So I thought I'd put this in because it's not all doom and gloom for you know, the tackle industry. This is the other end of the scale, one company that's doing well. And I know the people behind it have worked really hard to get towards this.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal, really, to float. I'm presuming it's because they have lots of outlets. I mean, are they not just in the north, or are they all over the country?
They are in mainly around Yorkshire, one in Manchester, one in Sunderland. There's Doncaster, Barnsley, Rotherham, Sheffield. I believe one planned in Birmingham, plus a big internet business, and lots of plans.
Well, obviously, we wish them luck. Anybody out there selling gear? I mean, I believe tackle shops, you know, the tackle shop industry is changing. I think people are going to move towards buying their yearly major items, not the consumables, the weekly stuff, but they're kind of the big items, the bed chairs, bivvies, rods, that sort of stuff. I think that trade's going to move more towards the consumer shows, much like our one, the Northern Angling Show. And it's tough. It's tough for any shop in a high street. So they're obviously doing something right. I mean, is it heavily discounted? Did they have all the brands, all the accounts?
Not all, but a lot of them. And I know, I don't know all, to be honest, but I know they were working hard to get more and open more shops, and they do compete with the prices. you know, they're always you know, checking it, competing with the other stores, and trying to stay one step ahead, like I'm sure everyone is.
Cool. Anything else we've seen on the net?
It's on the net. It must be true.
Not on the net. This was on the bank. This is last week. Yeah, you see what I've put in the notes. I've packed up the gears in the car and I'm giving the water a bit of a thrash with a marker rod. I walked into a swim. It was slightly overgrown, maybe not fished too much this year. And at the back of the swim was a great big brown human turd. I'm not joking. It's disgusting. There's a nice pile of soggy white toilet paper next to her, next to it. I don't know, I'm calling it a her like it's a ship. But it was honestly, it was like King Kong had laid cable in that swim. I just hope it gave the person who laid it some pain.
I had a bad story. I'm not sure if it was deliberate. I think it possibly was. When I was, I got a little secret camping spot on that coal mere years ago, allegedly, when I caught the common that we spoke about last week, the banana common. And there was a little hide. It was in amongst a load of holly trees, and it was perfect size for a bivvy. So I was setting my bivvy up in there. The first time I actually bivvied up in there, when I caught the first fish, I was just gone around there with the rods in the morning. And I managed to get a load of camo net in. And if it's set up right in the middle of this little area, you were completely hidden. So hidden, in fact, that a story I've told at a few slideshows regarding... I don't know if it's the time or place to tell the story now.
I think you should. It's one that needs to be told because it's funny.
Okay, well, I was in this little hide. I'd obviously caught fish, so I bivvied up in there the following week. There was literally one little gap to get to kind of walk into this, you know, between two holly bushes to walk into this little area, and your bivvy was surrounded by bushes, and by the time you had the camo netting over it, it was invisible. I'll maybe post the pictures up on our Facebook page, because it was pretty well hidden. You can't see a bivvy in there. And it's in the out of bounds area, so quite a lot of the time I was just in the bivvy, like keeping out the way, because you couldn't really see the water's edge, because it was all trees, the rods were out in the water, so you could walk round that point and not know I was there, like even though I was fishing in the bivvy, rods out in the water, like unless you were really looking. Another angler might find you, but your average person wouldn't. So I'm there, I hear voices. Like it's dog walkers. Occasionally dog walkers would venture off the path and occasionally like wander into that area, and if they did, I'd just keep out of the way, and they wouldn't find you. And I heard voices, so I've dived back in the bivvy, pulled the zip down, and just sat there quietly, and these voices were getting closer and closer. And it was a couple. I could hear a girl's voice, I could hear a guy's voice. I was like, oh, what are they doing walking in here? And, you know, didn't hear a dog or an animal or anything. And I was like, oh, they're not dog walkers. And they got closer and closer and closer. They're on top of me now. And I mean, on top of me. Next thing I hear, like a sheet, like some sort of plastic sheet being laid out, or like a ground sheet or something, and it's literally touching the side of the bivvy, and I'm like, no, what I think is maybe going on here can't be. But it was. The next thing I hear zips going and little giggles, and then it went dead quiet for about 20 seconds. Then I heard the guy go, and that was it. It was done.
That was it.
I was just like, can I have a go?
This is the first time.
And this was, like I say, it was, they can be no more than 3 feet from the bivvy, and I'm in there and I'm trying not to make a noise, trying not to laugh. I'm just like, oh dear. And then the mat got wrapped up and they were gone within like 90 seconds. I never saw him. Didn't have no idea of identity. So if you're anglers and you're listening to this, then I heard you, but I don't know it was you. quite funny, but testament to how well I was tucked away. I will, I'll dig the posters. It's old school, pre-digital cameras, this, but I'll dig the pictures out and scan them.
Was that day or night?
Daytime. It was like probably lunchtime, early afternoon.
That's probably why he was in a rush.
Yeah, I don't know. It was all a bit weird. Never heard a peep out of a pretty funny. But going back to said Bivvy story, so I've done that session. I came back for one session the week after, and I've gone to set the bivvy up in that spot. And I hadn't noticed till I'd set the bivvy up until it was too late. And there's literally human turd all up the sides of the bivvy. Like inside and out, where I've laid it on the floor, and there was no toilet paper anywhere to be seen. Somebody basically had a turd right in the middle of that little spot. But anyway, it's pretty hard to find this spot. So I don't know if it was another angler. Word was,
I think that's odds on.
Yeah, I don't know, but they'd basically crapped in my bivvy spot, and it ended up covering the bivvy so bad I slung it when I got home. having human turd all over the sides of your bivvy is not the one for a session, I can assure you. But don't shit in swims is about the
I carry I've got a little trowel. I've had it for years, actually. Just little hole, squat over and bury it. It's not hard, but also it reminds me of the best place I ever fished was I'll call it by its real name because nobody will ever know it. It's unless you're fishing, that's Hollywell Fen. But you had cows going down one side of the lake, and where they went for a drink, they left cow hoof sized holes that were up to a foot deep. So you had a ready made hole, you'd squat over one, leave your parcel, kick the top in, some mud over it, job done.
I think the craze these days is bag and tag it. That's what everybody I know has now been doing on the bank. It's shut the bivvy door into. There are certain bags without holes that are recommended over the cheap Tesco's ones that seem to have holes in them. But crap yourself in a bag. I've just got the angle right, leaning against the bed chair. Get yourself in a bag, bag it up, and in a black bin bag, and jobs are good. And
what if you're mid push and you get that screaming run from hell?
Well, the same as if you're in a bush at the back of the swim. It's the same outcome. Cause of nature accepted. They're even accepted in the EA rod licenses as a genuine reason for being off your rods, aren't they?
Yeah, so sorry I wasn't near my rods, officer. I was in the bush crapping.
Yeah. Shall we move on to the...
Just one thing before you mention the bagging and tagging thing. It reminded me of the young lad I worked with, Tom, the story he was telling me. And this is possibly the downside of urban angling. He was on a local park lake, which all the public go around. They feed the birds, they walk the dogs. And you know how the thing is nowadays, your dog has a crap, you pick it up in your bag and you deposit in a bin. Mm-hmm. Only... not everyone must have been putting them in a bin because he caught one.
Yeah, floated.
oh, it sunk. It was down there. It floats drifted a bit. It's got under. He's struck. He just felt this heavy resistance of this water-laden bag, complete with dog turd swinging in the air.
Nice.
he swung in, much to his mate's absolute amusement. And mine, actually, when he was telling me about it.
Shall we move on to some of the listeners' questions that we didn't get through last week? Ask us
a question. Yeah, I think this is going to be quite a popular feature this time. So I've asked some questions with the theme of watercraft. And what I've done, I've selected a few here, and we're going to split up and so we can give them proper answers and then carry on and go back to them next week. So we'll start. Adam Matthews. What if there is literally no sign of a fish? Nothing at all. Zero. Do you want to start this one?
Yep, I've been in this situation many times where maybe you get down to the lake really keen and you're looking around. I've done it where I've been determined not to go into a peg unless I see fish. and you don't see any. You know, you no sign of a car. You look all day, and it's getting to a point where you think, I need to set up somewhere. You know, it's gonna get dark, whatever. I will then go for kind of the next best thing. So I'll go for anywhere that's got any activity. So bits moving. I'll just look for the most active part of the lake. It might even be ducks. You know, it might even be that there's ducks hammering an area. I can't remember if we mentioned this before, but there's like, where it comes to ducks, there's two types of lake. You get some lakes where the carp chill with the ducks, and you'll see them showing amongst, you know, coops and whatever. And the divers, you know, Horseshoe's one of them. Wherever you see the ducks on Horseshoe, you'll see carp nutting amongst them. You see the big, you know, groups of hundreds of them out in the lake. It's common to see the carp showing in the middle of them. I know the Manchester Park Lake was the same on there. I've had ducks pick my bait up and carp pick it up within seconds of the ducks dropping it. And then you get other lakes.
Stick to the A1s.
Yeah, and then you get other lakes where the carp, where the ducks won't go anywhere near where the carp are. And I mean, they will spook. If a carp even swims through the area, the duck will take off vertically and shoot to the other side of the lake. And you, do you remember that day when me and you saw the lady? We were up the tree and we were fishing next to each other on St. Ives. And the lady swam in. We just seen a bat coming in towards us from the opposite side of the lake. Lee Jackson was on the other side of the lake, wasn't he? And he was on all the fish. He was in the works and they were showing all over him. And one solitary fish just left the works and swam over to the side of the lake when we were. We watched it all the way in and we were like, it can't be the lady. And it was.
And there's no mistake. She got close enough to see her width.
No mistake. It came in, and do you remember we were trying to float a fish for it and, you know, flick all sorts out, do whatever we could to try and get a take, and the ducks kept moving in on the floaters, and all the lady had to do was turn and look at the ducks and they shot off. It was like, even from like 15, 20 foot away, when the lady it scared them off once, and then because it was interested in the floaters, wasn't it, the lady? And then the birds like would edge in closer and closer, and all the lady had to do was turn round like as if it was going to look at them, and the ducks shot off again. I don't know if you remember that, but I never forget that. Go on.
I remember that one. Do you remember? I can't remember if it was you were fishing or it was someone else back in Pit 2 at Elstow. It's winter time, slope, and you're looking straight across to the low point decoy area, and someone had obviously been baiting up there at the bottom of the ledge, because the tufties were having a field day. You know, from the binoculars, you could see them coming up, boilers in the mouths. And then a fish, if I had a safe of it, I'm presuming it was scaly, you know, quite a long fish. There was nothing else in there at the time, similar shape and size. Cleared the water in the middle of them and scared them all off.
Yeah.
Quite literally, as if it were thinking, get off my bait.
Yeah.
It was easy to see.
I've seen it where, like I say, the ducks cohabit with the carp quite happily, and, you know, they sit together and, you know, they'll both be feeding on the same spot. And I've seen it the opposite way. So, like, if you've got any info like that, if you've... Because straight away when I'm working things out on a new lake, I'm looking for them sort of things that'll help you in the future. So if you know that the ducks and the carp... I mean, on Horseshoe, I think they actually choose to be together. Like, it's somebody pointed it out to me, and every time I went there, I mean, I fished there for years at lake when I was young, and once it was pointed out to me, like, wherever, if you couldn't see the carp, just look for the ducks. Wherever the ducks were, the carp was showing amongst them. And I don't know who followed who, but it was quite common back then. I mean, I don't know if it still is. Maybe somebody can let us know who's a Horseshoe regular. But
with what we've just said, you think Horseshoe, Pit 6, we've both had experiences of carp with ducks, well-stocked lakes. Elstow 2, St. Ives Lagoon, very low-stocked lakes. We've had the opposite. You think where they used to lots of carp, they're friends, they follow each other.
Possibly. Low-stock. Possibly. The only...
used to come into contact with the fish.
The Manchester Park Lake is, I wouldn't say that was heavy stocked, 19, 20 acres, 25 commons, 20 mirrors, something like that. It's not as low stock as somewhere like St. Ives, 20 fishing, 30 acres. But it's not heavily stocked even, and the fish do well, certainly there. I on two occasions in the same session, I had a duck pick me up and then a carp pick me up within seconds, almost as if it was creating the competition, you know, like the competition for food. Both times I thought it was a duck when it screamed off, because literally a duck had just grabbed it and then popped up to service and then it ripped. So I don't know, but it's definitely a point to consider. But say I notice either of those things, you know, say I notice the ducks are friendly with the carp and I can't find any carp, then in the absence of anything else, I might just settle where all the ducks seem to be. And or I'll certainly look for the most active area of the lake, like if there's other bits and stuff, you know, areas seem to be alive. So I mean, what do you look for if you can't find anything?
Three things are the obvious first to look for, and the very obvious: wind, weed, snags. We all know that carp follow the wind. It's a good starting point. Carp are never going to be far away from the weediest areas of the lake, and exactly the same with snags. And also, I'd try and find a swim that gave me a good view of the entire lake. I could sit up, I could watch. So we only need that one show. It can give away a lot of fish.
Yeah, if I can't find anything, then I will just set up somewhere where I've got the best view, without a doubt. And I totally can't argue with any of them points. You know, I quite often look for the weediest area of the lake, you know, the area with the thickest weed. It's quite often where the fish will be, especially at certain times of year when the weed in the spring, when there's not much weed about, where the weed comes first is where the fish like to be. They like cover. And I know, like, they love islands, don't they? And before the weed comes up on any lake, like, if there's an island, that's where they'll be. They'll be in the safest possible place. We could go on all day about these things. There's tons of things that I take for granted without even... Until somebody asks a question like this, you just sort of do it automatically. Yeah. A new wind, yeah, certainly, you know.
Yeah, just one other point before we move on. For this time of year, if you see bream spawning or tench or any other fish spawning, get in there, because the carp will be going in straight after and smashing it to bits.
Yeah, I've seen that so many times where the bream spawn. I remember Dave having a decent hit on Fen Drayton, which, you know, notoriously tricky lake. 2 years running, I think, when the bream was spawning around Spawning Bay Point, the carp are just in there eating it. And I've known a few people have decent hits when the bream is spawning.
Yeah, right. Shall we move on to the next one? And I know we're totally going to argue on this one.
Ask us a question.
Chris Bannister says, can you explain why moon phases hold such high esteem with a lot of carp anglers and not so much with any other type of angler, as far as I'm aware? Well, I'll answer the second part. Speak to any eel anglers and they worship the moon.
Yeah, the second bit is completely incorrect. Most of the apps for moon phases are not carp fishing apps. The main one I use is called, I forget what it is on my phone now.
Fishing calendar or FishCal, something like that.
FishCal, yeah. Which basically, it's a sea fishing app. Sea fishing is where most of the moon phase info comes from. Sea anglers live by the moon, because of the tides, obviously, and because of the peak times. On the FishCal app, it has major periods and minor periods, and it explains on it. I'll try and get it up on Google while we're talking about it, but because it's quite a good explanation of how it works. But they believe that fishing is at its most prime when the moon and the sun are opposite each other. They're like the peak times during a day. As far as different moon phases, I mean, I wouldn't say that carp anglers are. I'm still in the minority with my moon views. If nothing else, we all know what carpy weather is like. We all know when it feels carpy. We all kind of get that feeling. You know, it's the pressures drop below 1,000. It's a really warm wind, and it's just moody. Well, the moon does seem to control weather. When we have full moons, there's the moons are roughly lunar, though lunar month is slightly different to the normal calendar, but if we assume like every 4 weeks there's a new moon, every 4 weeks there's a full moon, every 4 weeks there's a first quarter, every 4 weeks there's a last quarter. Now, so let's assume there's 12 a year. It's not quite exact because there's not 4 weeks in every month, but the lunar cycle is roughly every 4 weeks. So let's assume there's 12 full moons a year, there's 12 new moons a year. Out of those 12 full moons, probably 9 of them will be high pressure. You do occasionally get a low pressure full moon, but usually it's high pressure. 1,026 plus. And if you look at 9 out of the 12 new moons, they'll be low pressure, moody, carpy conditions. So whether you believe the moon caused you to catch is neither here nor there. The fact is if on a new moon the weather gets really carpy, then more fish are going to get caught. So even if you don't believe in the moon, just look at what it does to the weather, and you can't argue with that. Every time the new moon comes, check the weather outside. Or every time we get carpy weather, check the moon. Do it that way around.
As an aside, do you know what the moon phase is doing right now?
I'm guessing, right, this is an absolute shot in the dark because I don't know, but it's below 1,000 and it's moody as hell outside. So if I had to guess, I would say, are we on a new moon period?
No, the full moon is tomorrow.
All right, well, it's one of the, like I say, there's two or three a year full moons that go low pressure. And I don't know why, but they do. And the rest of the time, the full moons are high pressure. But some lakes fish better on high pressure. If you remember, St. Ives was a high pressure water. Yateley was a high pressure water, the Car Park Lake. So I think you need to check your lake. You know, if your lake fishes well on high pressures, then maybe, you know, target the full moons. And vice versa, you know, lots of lakes fish well when it's really moody. I know a few lakes that just don't, you know, it's really carpy and it looks like it's going to go off, and some lakes just don't fish in those conditions. They're like the hot weather lakes, as I call them, the full moon lakes. So are we on a full moon at the minute?
Tomorrow.
Right, interesting.
And I've just packed up from Icom earlier on with white horses racing down the lake.
Yeah, well, like, it's a good job I cover myself by saying two or three a year. And there is always one at this time of year. I mean, mark this full moon in at the end of May, start of June. Have a look next year if that same full moon is a low pressure.
Yeah, well, no doubt we'll still be doing this, so we'll have to bring it up. Keep an eye on the moon and the weather. I think we should do this, you know, throughout the year, just out of interest, and, you know, if listeners post any captures or observations on our page, as well as our own fishing observations.
While searching for the fishing calendar, there's quite a few. I use a MacBook, and so I've got iCal on there, but there's a Sol Lunar calendar for the MacBook, which is actually for bass fishing. But I know it's the sea fishing mainly that use the moon. The carp thingy has been quite new. What date are we on today? The 2nd of June. Monday the 1st of June we're recording this, because it'll be out on Friday the 5th when you hear this show. It's full moon at the minute. And I'm looking at an American fishing calendar here, or Sol Lunar calendar. There are certain fish that love getting caught on certain moons. I've always found that new moons, that there are certain carp. I mean, Mr. Angry out of the Manchester Park Lake, that there was, it's just come out recently, not on a new moon. But I think something like 8 out of its previous 9 captures were within a day either side of the new moon. And I can name many other examples of specific fish being caught on a new moon within a day or two either side, and that's too much for coincidence.
I agree with you there, and I know there is a lot of evidence like that with particular fish, but what gets me is there is always the exception, and I can't really see any scientific connection between what the moon is doing and the fish feeding. Because you're not telling me that Mr. Angry doesn't feed in between certain moon phases.
Yeah, no. If it feeds, of course it does.
Getting caught.
Of course it does, but my theory on when we catch fish, especially the tricky fish, we catch them when they want to be caught. So we catch them when they're feeding heavy enough to throw caution to the wind. The rest of the time when it's picking, I think your rigs need to be stupidly efficient to have any chance of catching the tricky ones, because they're not feeding hard enough, or they've not thrown caution to the wind. You know, it's like when you get them lump weeks where all the big ones come out all over the country, all in the space of 3 or 4 days, and everybody catches, like the good anglers, the bad anglers, recreational anglers, guys that maybe just go out for fun, don't take it quite as seriously. Everybody catches. And we catch because they're feeding so hard and there's competition for food. They're all, you know, they're all wanting to eat, and they drop their guard. And I think we catch, especially the tricky fish, we catch when they want to be caught. That's why there's always a week in May where all the big fish in the country get caught. Although we're a little bit behind this year because, you know, the water's still cold. That's why a lot of places haven't spawned yet as we talk, you know, 2nd of June, and there's quite a few places not spawned yet. And in fact, most, I would say 90% of lakes haven't spawned yet, which is unusual. And there's always a week, sort of September, where all the big ones get caught, and sometimes November as well. And it's when they decide, you know, we need a feed up.
I can't argue with that, although I suspect I'm in the same situation as almost everyone else, is that whatever the moon phase is doing, I fish when I'm off work.
Yeah, but let's say you're planning a trip to France next year, and you've got an option of, you know, what week are we going to go away in May? Well, I'm going to pick the new moon week. If I'm going to go somewhere specifically, I'm going to pick the new moon week. Say your missus lets you fish 2 weekends a month, then why would you fish the in-between weekends? If it doesn't really matter which weekend you fish, then I'm going to fish the one nearest to the new moon, the full moon, I think, which seems to be the two best weeks. So you know, you can slightly doctor your days, or let's say you can, you know, let's say you fish midweek, but it doesn't really matter which days you fish midweek, you're just allowed to fish 2 nights. And you know, you could fish Monday, Tuesday night, or Tuesday, Wednesday night, or Wednesday, Thursday night. Well, let's say, you know, over this quarter, the all the moon periods, the peak periods, i.e. the new moon, the quarter, the last quarter and the full moon, let's say they seem to be dropping towards the end of a week, I'm going to fish the Wednesday, Thursday or Thursday, Friday instead of the Monday, Tuesday. So you can doctor your session slightly to get as close to it. I mean, that's how I do it anyway. If I know I'm going to go fishing at some point in the next couple of weeks, and it's an in-between period this week, well, there's a new moon next week, I'm going to go next week.
Yeah. Here's a thought, though, with what you've said about the correlation between the moon phase and the weather. Is it the moon that affects the fish, or the weather it brings?
Well, this is my point: is it doesn't matter if the moon brings carpy weather.
Same with, yeah.
If the moon brings carpy weather, then we know that we catch more fish in carpy weather. So it doesn't matter why. If we know that we get better carpier weather when there's a new moon, then why would you not just fish on a new moon? And we know the moons control the tides. I mean, it's all down to water pressure and air pressure. I mean, you know, the moon's always controlled the tides on a number of other planets other than just us. Okay, let's welcome into the fold Mr. Holmes.
So I've got some notes here, but so before we got going, is there anything you want to get off your chest that we can lead into, or any stories you think would be good?
No, really. The one thing that I do, obviously, people who know me know that and you've got to be careful when you're in the media, because if you start proclaiming you this or you're proclaiming that, then it can get misconstrued as either a touch of arrogance or a touch of delusion or grandeur. I've none of them, but I do tend to get labelled because if I'm outspoken about a particular subject. So I'll give you an example. When the first article I ever wrote, which was in 1983, I wrote an article for a magazine called Course Angler. I was proclaiming that casting long distances, which was the day on the water that I was fishing, this circuit water in Lancashire, they were all casting distances, and they were all formed up, for those that remember, and using ultra-tight lines with heavy bobbins at the top. And I was catching fish under the rod tip with ultra-slack lines, and I was advocating that these guys were missing a trick and shouldn't be doing this and shouldn't be doing that. So I became known as a bit of a margin angler, when the reality was is that I was just doing the tactics that I needed to on that particular water to catch those fish. Latterly, I got noted as a guy who would fish smaller waters and catch big fish from smaller waters, and nobody ever knew of the big fish that I'd caught from larger waters. And then I started talking about bait, latterly, and people think, oh, I'm some sort of bait guru. And then I started talking about the problems with otters and angling politics. And obviously, a little known fact is I've been chairman of the fourth biggest angling club in the country for nearly over 20 years. So I know all about angling politics. So when I started to meet angling politicians for the first time, they were rather patronising at times, almost indicating that I didn't know my arse from my hole in the ground. And when I actually told them, look, I've actually run, you know, I've been chairman of this club for blah, 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 and I've been this and I've been that and that, they were staggered. So without, you know, being too pompous, I am quite multifaceted, and people tend to forget that until they actually see one of my shows or they listen to me talk, and then they realise that whether they love me or hate me, I have actually been around an awful long time in this game.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that's something that comes across in these sort of things, because back on second one, we had Ali Amidi on, where a lot of people pigeonhole him as called this a complete plug fest, which, you know, I chat with him because him and Jamie go way back, was the complete opposite. So, right, I'll just do a little intro and then we'll crack on. So, Jamie's had to disappear, so it's me and our guest this week, so I'd like to welcome our most requested guest for the Carpcast, Mark Holmes.
Very pleased to be welcomed onto the airwaves, Mark, and without having people throw up at this early stage of the interview, it's very humbling that all my family have requested that I'm allowed on here.
Yeah, I'm sure you didn't have to pay them too much.
No. But no, seriously, it's... yeah, it's nice to be asked on, mate. And when I met you and Jamie at the Northern Angling Show, and you mooted this idea, I was all up for it, because I think that contrary to popular belief about me being old school and stuck in the past, I think that any new venture that reaches out to grassroots anglers about what carp angling is to be welcomed, because the medium in the past of the written media and magazines and the rest of it can only do so much. And when I actually started getting involved in collating and editing the written media and all the rest of it, which we may talk about coming onto it, I realised that you are very one-dimensional when you read something. When you actually meet the people who are behind the words and behind the photographs, you start to understand a little bit more about them, and more importantly, you start to understand the man. And that, to me, is the be-all and end-all. I don't care if someone's caught a huge amount of carp if they're not a very nice person to be with. As I get older and uglier, to me, the benefit of this game is that you meet some nice people. And a lot of people might think otherwise, because I can be quite caustic myself at times, but there are far more good'uns than bad'uns. And it's a trait of younger people to always remember the bad'uns. Well, I'll give you a little tip, lads. There's an awful lot more good'uns, and I think as you get older, you realise that those are the ones that you should concentrate on.
Oh, without a doubt, Mark. I've got some wonderful friends through fishing, and I think I can count the wrong ones I've met on pretty much one hand.
Yeah, definitely, mate. And I think that's, again, you know, I've got a little bit more mileage on the clock than yourself, Mark, but the reality is that we kind of cut from the same cloth. We're both Northern Anglers. We both had to travel around. And the reality is that it's exactly the same when people talk about the North-South divide. Again, I don't want to, you know, this is for kids to listen to, so I won't be swearing and effing and jeffing, but an a-hole is an a-hole, whether it's from Yorkshire, the Midlands, or the South. A nice person is a nice person, whether it's from Yorkshire, Midlands, or the South. And one thing I've realised is that when you do travel up and down the country, you actually meet all different types of people. And generally, it's got very, very little to do with geography. It's more to do with your own mindset.
Yeah, without a doubt. So let's go back then. You started catfishing, was it 1975?
I did, and I'll be honest with you, Mark, I was quite fortunate and or unfortunate in that I was a northern boy, and my father moved us down to Newmarket. And my claim to fame, or my infamy, was that, would you believe I went to the same school as John Bannister? Or I always say to people that John Bannister went to the same school as Mark Holmes. Because I was actually...
Is that the way of putting it?
Yeah, that's the way I put it, because I was there 7 years before John. But seriously, joking aside, I love Johnny to bits and got a lot of time for him. But the reality is that both John and I went to Newmarket Upper School because my father was in the worked for the stable in the stable game, and we got a tide cottage. And I don't want people crying in the beer when they listen to this, but the only reason why my dad used to move us down there was if he got into too much debt in Yorkshire, he'd do a moonlight flip, and we'd all move down there. And in those days, if you worked in the horse game, you generally got what was known as a tide cottage, and that meant that you got, as part of your benefit for working, you got a house thrown in. So we lived in the middle of a huge country estate, which was very, very famous, called Cheveley Park, and those in the racing fraternity will know that. Well, on that estate was a lake of about acre and a half, and there were carp in there that were just short of double figures, and I used to chase them around with a peacock quill that was I used to use 4 dust shot. Can you believe they were that small? I used to use 4 dust shot, and I used to fish brandlings, and however caught it was beyond belief, but I used to chase them around. So I'd see fish, I'd watch them, and I'd watch the patrol routes, and then I'd cast out to them with this brandling. And they'd either take it or they wouldn't take it. Invariably, most of the time, they wouldn't take it. But it learned me an awful lot, A, about small waters, and B, about actually fishing for fish that you could visually see.
Yeah, I think that's what a lot is missing about some of the carp nowadays, or the carp scene nowadays, is a lot of people that have not done that. They've gone straight into carping.
Well, this is the thing, Mark, and this is one of the things which, the likes of Bruno Fats like me have to cut people some slack. If you've only got the likes of Brasenose or Linear and you're born in this era and that's the type of fishing that you've grown up with, you can't go around flicking them in the edge and all the rest of it, because the reality is that the swims are taken, and that's why most of the tactics that I developed later on in life was where I didn't have to move and I didn't have to go chasing the fish. Because if you're in a peg, say on Manor, down on the Linear complex, and a fish nuts out on the other side, well, it doesn't mean anything to you, because you can't up sticks and move across it, because mate is there, and there's probably mate's mate bivvied up behind him ready to move in anyway. So the reality is that a lot of the tactics that the likes of you and I and all the carp anglers use to actually understand how carp feed and how you should go about being quiet and diligent and all those buzzwords, the reality is that the carp angling of today bears little resemblance to the carp angling of yesterday.
Yeah, I agree with you there, but it's just a change of the scene. I don't want you to say sound like I'm saying there's anything wrong with it, because that's what a lot of people know, and it does take a special sort of angler to really stand out on the likes of Brasenose.
It does, and you mentioned him earlier on about Ali Amidi, and I love Ali to bits, but Ali was always going to be famous. He was a little bit like the carp version of Matt Hayes. I met Matt Hayes, came and did us a show in Bradford when I ran a little specimen group there, and Matt was a lovely, lovely guy, but he told me he was going to be famous and make a lot of money out of fishing. Well, Ali Amidi was always going to be famous as well, because he was a marketing guru, and that's what he wanted to do. And I remember when I was editor of Advanced Carp Fishing, he said to me, I want to be in the magazine, And me being the caustic old git that I was, I'm talking about 10 years ago, I said, well, you've caught now. What do you mean I've caught now? I said, well, you've caught now. I said, this is Advanced Carp, not Total Carp. I said, you've caught now. Well, I've had this and I've had that. I said, yeah, but that's no. I said, two or three decent fish don't mean you're a big fish angler. Tell you what to do, Ali. Come back to me when you've caught some. Well, of course, when I used to put the phone down, I used to be laughing, because I could imagine him going absolutely ballistic on the other end of the phone. I've fished Reeds Mare and I've done this and I've done that. And I used to just wind him up. But one day, I rang him up and I said, look, I tell you what we'll do. If you're that desperate to be in the magazine, I'll do a feature with you called Behind the Mask. And he said, well, what's behind the mask? I said, well, you know, it's self-explanatory. I said, I've got people like Derek Ritchie. I said, Derek appears a bit of a clown and a fool, but the reality is behind Derek is an awful lot of history of carp fishing that people don't know about. I said, with you, you come across as this marketing guru and all the rest of it. I said, and I'm sure there's more behind it. And I said, I'm sure there's more in your own fishing than your public perception. Oh, I'll look for that, up for that. So anyway, we arranged to go to this water in Essex. And I turned up, which can only be described as an old man's allotment. And it makes me smile when people moan and groan about artificial fisheries these days. This place was literally an old man's allotment. There were all sorts of shrubbery and little fountains and ornaments and all the rest of it. But anyway, we turned up. And again, you know, the great and good love this water because it had a fish called the Pat's Common, which I think was nearly 40 pounds. And we goes down there. And Ali was with, lovely lad called Richie Loftus. Yeah, Richie Loftus, who I think is one of the Corder boys. He ended up catching that, one of them big fish out of, that Jim Shelley caught, that 50, that, I think they called it the pet or something, or it'll come to me before the end of the interview. But he caught a big fish, and a good fish angler was Richie. And anyways, he was one of Ali's mates, and he was sat there as well. And we started the interview, we put the tape recorder on. And my first question, and honestly, you had to be there to see Ali's face. My first question, because I never pull any punches. My first question to Ali Amadi was, right, Ali, are you the unacceptable face of today's carp fishing? Well, I'll never forget, he literally started waving his hands at me to switch off the recorder. So, you know, being a nice guy, I switched it off. And he said to me, he says, what kind of question's that? I said, look, I told you when I rang you up that this is behind the mask, and the public perception of you for a large amount of people is that you are the unacceptable face of carp fishing. In other words, the commercialism that you promote in order to promote the company that you work for, a pay your wages, which you should do because you're a marketing man, whether it's fishing, shoes, suits, cars or nothing, it's still a commodity that you're selling. I said a lot of people, particularly older end, think that you're an unacceptable face of carp fishing. And to Ali's benefit, he actually thought about it really, really deeply, and he came back with an answer which actually, and if he's listening to this, I don't want him to ring him, so that's a lovely thing to say, because I don't give plaudits out cheaply. But Ali Amadi turned around to me and said, Holmesy, remember, you can only live in the times that you're born. I can't go back to casting out potatoes. I can't go back to when the first boilies were coming out. I can't go back to the secretive days. He said, I can only live in the times that I was born in. And I think at the time, Ali must have been, I don't know, 26, 27. And I thought that was a very profound thing for him to say.
That's a good answer.
And it is a good answer. And it resonated with me. It resonated with me because we all suffer from that. If people who talk about the good old days and these legendary places such as Redmire Pool and how great and good some of these guys were, then and exactly the same when they hold up Richard Walker as the godfather of carp fishing and the purveyor of all that's good and true, some of them forget that towards the end of his life, Richard Walker hated carp fishing. He hated it because it had become something that he didn't want it to become. It had become mainstream. It had become too commercial. He didn't like the set lines and all the rest of it. And I couldn't quite understand that. But as I'm getting older, I think what it is that a lot of old-school established carp anglers find change difficult. And if you have to be relative to today, you have to take on board some of the changes that are there. But the important thing is for you to understand the human psyche. And the human psyche, and it was funny, Jamie's not here to answer this, but I heard Jamie talking to Simon Crowe that this year he kind of lost his mojo a little bit, and he wasn't getting the same buzz that he'd got in the past when he'd chased individual fish. Well, I think that is, and that does happen to every single carp angler who stays the distance. If you imagine your natural enthusiasm, your natural aggression as a young man, it tapers, and you cannot endure that level of enthusiasm and almost aggression to catch the ultimate fish and come out of it the other side grounded. And those of us old enough to remember will remember examples of famous people who have lost it big time. They've spent too long on the bank. One of the things I won't do in this interview really, Mark, is say bad things about people. I've spoken about Ali Amadi, but I spoke about him in a good light. I'll try not to speak about particular people in a bad light because I don't believe in that. But there are classic examples of people that have been on the bank and have become mentally ill, lost it. There are people that have had to do other things, recreational drugs and all the rest of it to get past the boredom. But the reality is that all of us can fish too much sometimes. And provided you're able to pull back the balance in your life, you come through it. So you will find that those of us who are now in their 40th year of carp fishing have been able to balance their lives where sometimes I've done it harder than other times. But I've always realised the danger signs. And the danger signs today are that if you are looking to your left and to your right at other people's results, all that ultimately will end with is disappointment. Because let me tell you, lots of successful carp anglers have no social skills, no home life, no girlfriend. If they did have her, they're probably losing her. They're probably odd. They're probably ugly. And they probably can't get a bird. So the reality is that the big fish album, in reality, comes at a price. And anybody, from full-timers to the guy who goes overnight, and this is the great thing about carp fishing, anybody in this country of carp fishing has the right to choose what they want, and I will not pull them down. But what I will say to guys who are looking to be the next big name, the next big thing, the next sponsored angler, is that you can achieve anything you want, but for everything in life, for every action, there's a reaction. And I'm not some guru, Mark. I've just realised that's the way that it is. And if you're going to get to where you want to get, just realise that there's a price to be paid.
Well, I think the key word you mentioned there was balance. I know from my own experience, because I became obsessed on Elstow 2 with catching the twin, and to be honest, it's a good job I caught her when I did, because I was overdrawn. I was almost single. Mm. I didn't fish for about 6 or 7 weeks after I caught it, while I put my life back on track and learnt the important lesson.
Well, you know, I held the Yorkshire record for a while with a big fish, and took me a while to catch it, and it was actually a proper leather. It always makes me laugh when people are going about, oh, I had this leather, and I see the pictures, and there were scales at the top. And I think, well, that's not leather. Leather never has a scale on it. And I'm going back to the days when there were proper leathers. I think these days they call them nude leathers. I don't know who nipped that in there, but a leather was a leather to me. But I caught a real nude leather, and it was a Yorkshire record for the time, and I caught it from the Ripon Racecourse. I caught Lucy. And I remember it would have been the early 80s, and I had a Nash canvas overwrap, and it was one that would retain the water. And I remember falling asleep in the winter, having a full night's kip. I did sort of 9 hours, and I woke up, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And I sat there in the rain, listening to the rain on this canvas bibby, thinking, my God, and unbelievable, when I caught the fish, there was no sense of elation. There was just a sense of, thank God, this is over. And I think that this is ultimately the key. I always say to people, the pain of losing a fish stays with you far longer than the elation of catching a fish. And sometimes, if we're not careful, it can get us by the throat. And as you very much alluded to with the twin, when I wasn't, and I've done it, and I said I would never do it again, but I've done it recently with quite a few big fish that I've caught. But when you're not there, you think it's going to come out. When you see a fish nut, you think it's that fish. When you lose a fish, it's that fish. And I think, again, it's an age thing. As you get older, you realise that you've just got to occasionally pull yourself to one side, look in the mirror and say, have a word, mate. It's just fishing. And recently I caught a very prestigious fish. And I caught this fish twice. And I never told anybody the story because I didn't want to come across as a bigot or the rest of it. But the reality is that when it came out that I'd caught this fish twice, there were editors and stuff saying, oh, you could have been on the front cover of this and could have been on the front cover of that, and you could have done this and you could have done that. I did it for myself. And that's the thing that I always say to people. I will help people catch whatever they want to catch and do my best to help them catch, provided they're doing it for themselves. And that's ultimately what will give you longevity in carp fishing. Because there'll be time, Mark, as you said, you'll have no money, you'll have young kids, you've got to settle down. If I get on the stairs like I do when I do these slideshows up and down the country and tell people I've got limitless time, I get on my bait for free, I get on my tackle free, I do this, I do that. A guy sat in the front row who's got two young kids, his wife only let him go every other weekend. He can only get two nights in, so he's fishing four nights a month. Well, look at me. He uses 5 kilos a weekend. He'll look at me and think, well, this guy might be from Mars. He's talking a completely different language to me. It has nothing to do with me and my fishing. And that's why whenever I do these talks and whenever I do these shows, I always try and make it so that there's a connection there with grassroots anglers. Because ultimately, that, I think, is the biggest obligation now of people in the trade. And people get me wrong. They say Mark Holmes is anti-commercial. No, I'm not. What I'm anti is anti-lazy commercialism. Commercialism with a guy holding a pot of the latest magic up saying, buy this and you'll be as good as me, is a nonsense. The reality is you've got to connect with grassroots anglers so that they will want to come to you and say, you know what, Mark, we really love your fishing. You know what, Jamie, we love your fishing. You know what, Watto, we love your fishing. Tell us how you do it. Can you help us? Can you help us? And that's what I try and do. Don't get me wrong, I won't tell them, go on my water and use my tactics. No, because I'm still an old-style carp angler. But I'll try and put them on the right lines of their waters as to how to catch. And that, I think, is ultimately what I want to try and do for carp fishing.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there, Mark. It's, I think a lot of the, you know, you look at magazines and there's people parading big fish over everywhere. It does give a bit of a misrepresentation of a lot of the time and effort and sacrifice that is put into it.
Well, I think the thing is now, funnily enough, Mark, I just looked about an hour before we did this recording at the latest carp talk, and the amount of 50s that are about now are just absolutely unbelievable. The amount of 40s, just absolutely incredible. And I think that's all good, but I think that what you've got to be careful of is you've got to be careful of, particularly if you come from the areas that we come, that some form of, not bitterness, but some cause of grumpiness comes in, as if you look down on someone because they've caught a lot of big fish very quick and your perception is they've not had to work for it. The reality is that, and I always use this little analogy, Mark, is if I said to you, I'll tell you what, bud, we'll go to Newcastle, and you walk from Doncaster to Newcastle, it might take you, I don't know, 3 days, and I jump on the Concorde from Doncaster and I get there in 10 minutes. When we're in the boozer 3 months down the line, bud, we can both say we've been in Newcastle. It has no understanding of you walking 3 days and me being on Concorde for 10 minutes. And that's why I always say to people, you've got to narrow it down to that. It's just fishing. Ultimately, be remembered as a nice bloke who'll catch a few fish. Don't be remembered as an a-hole who caught a lot of fish.
I totally agree with you there again. Now, just coming out, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about. I know you've probably, obviously not like a broken record for you, but you're curing baits.
Yeah, I'll be honest, actually, Matt. It surprised me at the wonderment that people had about this, because, you know, there's a lot of people out there now who are selling forms of curing baits and all the rest of it, and we even had some people saying, oh, you've copied this and you've copied that. And it just absolutely amazes me. I mean, if you look at the first time I went into print about cure baits, it would have been about 2007. So in any layman's terms, that's 8 years ago. So, you know, it's not a new phenomenon for me. The reality is that I understand more as I get older that in order to catch the fish that I want to catch, I have to learn about the fish. Now, there's two types of carp fishing. There's fishing for carp, and there's fishing against the guy to the left and to the right. And it's easy for me, if I'm on a privileged water, if I'm on a syndicate that's very difficult to get in, which some people perceive difficult to get in, if I'm on a water that doesn't receive a lot of pressure, if there's not a lot of members, those sort of waters where you can go and you've got room to breathe and move about, make decisions and move on to shoring fish and all the rest of it, that aren't busy. They allow you to pit your wits against the carp. That is light years away from carp fishing for so many day ticket and weekend only anglers. Now there, you've got to watch what the guy does to the left and what the guy does to the right, because no matter how good you are, if he's reasonably close to you, he will affect your chances. And I remember once having a conversation with Gary Bayes, and Gary, who is one of the nicest men, the man about how many fish he's caught, the man about his knowledge of bait, don't mean jack to me. He's one of the loveliest human beings we ever meet. Lovely, lovely fella. And I love spending time with him. And he said to me, he said, you know what, Holmes? He says, I don't know what you like. He said, but if you don't like me, he said, I always like the lump of wood to be near me on the water. And I said, oh, I can't understand that, Gary. I would have wanted him down to the side of the lake. He said, no. He said, I like to know what he's doing, then I can change my plan accordingly. And I always thought that was a very, very clever answer, because then he could give him a few pointers and help him out so that really he realised that he wasn't affecting the guy next to him. And also, he could sleep at night, could Gary, because he knew he was trying to help the guy. And I thought that was a lovely attitude to have. And you know, the sort of last 10 years of me carp fishing, I've tried to do that. You know, I do try and help people. And salt is just one of them. And so when I actually decided to come out and tell people, you know, they said, well, where's he catching all these big fish from, and how's he catching these big fish? Where till the day I die is a very, very personal thing to me, because that's the most important thing in fishing, where you go. How you can share it. And so I decided that I won't give everybody my edges, but people were interested in how I caught so many. And so I decided to let a few cats out of the bags, and the response has been, well, I can't tell you, Mark, it's been absolutely overwhelming. The amount of people who, I won't say I'm on my every word, but the amount of plaudits that I have and good things that people say about me because I help them catch fish, it's really humbling me, and I get a real buzz from it, Mark, as I'm getting older and uglier, I'll be honest, bud.
Yeah, it is nice helping people. I mean, I was chatting with a friend earlier today. He was telling me a story. He'd been in a tackle shop, and someone else had recognised him as a friend of mine, because he's another big, lanky, long-haired northerner who generally says exactly what he thinks. And he told my friend to thank me when he sees me. Apparently, he'd been to a slideshow I'd done in the Apex, or the Hike and Sailing Club, many years back, where I'd been talking about Elstow 2, which had spurred this fella on to get a ticket, and he'd had the best 4 years of his fishing, caught some of the nicest fish out there as well.
Yeah,
just hearing a story like that, it made the blank I packed up from this morning seem a lot nicer.
Well, it does. I mean, the thing about it is you know, going back to the salt question, the reality is that, you know, because now of the medium of the social media, you know, everybody's got a little video on their phone and all the rest of it. And when I did start to do these, as opposed to articles, when I actually started to talk about it, because an article, you've got a word count restriction, you've got an editor who wants you to be succinct and to the point. And when you start to be technical, being succinct and to the point can be quite difficult. When you actually have got a 30-minute slot in an open audience, there you're able to put a little bit more meat on the bones. And so I think John Bannister actually did this film for me, and he put it on YouTube, and the response was absolutely incredible. And then I got involved with DNA Baits, who I'd never, ever, 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 ever wanted to be associated with a bait company, because I'm very, very guarded about what I do. But they are the only company that I would ever be associated with, because the guy that is a bait man behind him, I knew as a young boy. He's 10 years younger than me, and of course nowadays, when we're all old and falling apart, 10 years is nothing. But when you're sort of 26, 27, as I was, and raping and pillaging the waters of the north, he was a real mad keen 15, 16-year-old. He used to look up to me and almost say to worship, and I never got into that. And he said to me, bless him, when we spoke to me about getting involved with DNA Baits, he said, you know, Holmes, he said, the first thing I can remember about you, he said, we was on this water, me and my friend. He said, and you were doing your usual self-take, because I was just taking my own pictures. He said, and I had my binoculars on you. He said, and as I put my binoculars on you, he said, you put the fish down and put two fingers up to me. I thought, well, that sounds a little bit like the Mark Holmes of his mid to late 20s. So it was, we had a bit of a laugh and a joke about it. But that's how it was, Mark. You knew what it was like. You didn't like anybody knowing your secrets or anything. But now I look back and sometimes I hang my head a little bit, but it was a different era. So when he said, come and join us, I said, look, I want to do what I want to do, but I want to do this and want to do that. And what he did do is he actually opened up another side to me in relation to the bait world and helping people. And that is, when you start to deal with the masses, then talking about bespoke ideas, which work just for you, you've got to be very, very careful. And I'll give you a classic example. You spoke about Elstow. I can remember, Mark, when I raped and pillaged Yorkshire and Lancashire, and I caught a lot of big fish from there, kept it quiet. And then I moved down into the Midlands or south of the Midlands into Northamptonshire. And I used to put my bank sticks in. And then after a while, I started realising that my bank sticks were getting discoloured. Mm. And then a large penny dropped. I realised that the water tables of the lakes that I was fishing in the south bore no resemblance to the water tables in the north. And so basically what that meant was the actual medium that they lived in was a different thing. So the pH varied, the springs were different, they ran over different rock strata, and all this thing clicked into my brain. And that's when I realised that carp are an individual animal. And if you have chance to study that fish in its natural environment, it will tell you the secrets of how to catch it. And so that was a massive switch to me. And once that penny dropped, then I've been able to change my tactics accordingly and catch some nice fish, mate.
Yeah, again, I'm enjoying listening to this, to be honest.
You'll have noticed fishing down at Elstow. Did you notice how your bank sticks used to get discoloured down there?
Not so much on Elstow. I mean, it was all clay there. Mm. But I have, when I moved on to, up to Cambridgeshire, the more like gravelly waters,
yeah.
You know, and especially the amount of water that they lost on a hot summer.
Mm.
You know, and again, there's different wildlife. There's that top secret park lake, the one that's signposted from the A1. That is totally different from anywhere else I've ever fished.
It is, and you know, the reality is that you have to look for a window. And the one thing I say to people when they say, oh, you know, how can we catch so many big fish and you know, and all this. And I've got to say, I am naturally secretive. And the only reason why I've thrown a few good fish in there is because, and I hate this bit about carp fishing, it's one of those sports where you can get up and give a great tactic, a great idea forward, and then some wag at the side of you will say, well, have you ever caught? And this is unfortunate. What's good about carp fishing is bad about it. It's almost like a game of trumps on cards. And in order for you to be able to get up there and tell people and get the respect and, more importantly, get people to try the tactics that you're putting forward, you have to show them something that has proved to you how it's worked. And I'll give you a classic example. When I got up and did that talk about salt, one of the things which I mentioned was me actually watching fish in the water and how they were rubbing themselves in the clay, because I believe, without a shadow of a doubt, that there are certain things that they are looking for. They're looking for certain types of phosphorus. They're looking for something that creates magnesium, because magnesium is not a natural product. So they're looking for certain reactions between different types of chemicals that will get that, and they're also looking to get trypsin in their body. And I've spoke about this lots and lots of times, but certain amino acids and all the rest of it. But basically, they ingest it through their skin. And of course, all the scientific fact was that only sea fish can ingest certain things through their skin, and a carp can only ingest it by either it going in their mouth or whatever, through their face and not on their sides. And all these people came on and saying it's scientifically riddled with inaccuracies and this is rubbish and this is a dangerous thing that he's advocating and all the rest of it. And I did a slideshow about 4 months later, and there'd been all these forums where all these people far more learned than me were saying that these tactics were wrong and they were dangerous. And I thought, right, I know these guys are going to be sat, these bait gurus are going to be sat right at the front of the audience at this particular show. And so what I did, Mark, was I showed a slide of a 48 and a 41 I'd caught within 10 minutes of each other, and I showed a slide of 250s that I'd never shown before. And that was it. And I just showed them the first 4 slides. I went bang, 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 bang. And I said, right, for those people who think scientifically, my tactics are flawed, I'm not bothered. For those of you who want to catch fish like those four, now we can start listening. End of. Because what are they caught? What, you know, don't get me wrong, that doesn't make their theories wrong or whatever, but what it does do, it instantly kills their credibility. Because at the end of the day, I'm not a scientist guru who sits in a lab with fish in a controlled environment trying to develop things. All I've ever done is want to catch the next big fish, Mark. And this is what annoyed me when certain people started throwing things at me saying, oh, he's fishing a garden pond, he's doing this, he's a... They were trying to make people who didn't know my history see me as someone who was single-faceted and could only do this type of thing. Not at all. All I've ever done is think, I want to catch him, I want to catch her, how can I do it? And change my tactics accordingly. And recently I did a slideshow down at Carping On in Essex, and I stood up there and I said, right, this is my 40th year of carp fishing. I said, now then, you catch two good fish a year. I said, that's not really massive, is it, in this day and age? I said, but if I've caught two good fish a year, I said, that's 80 big fish that I've had. I said, so that's some slideshow that some guy can put together. I said, so what I'm trying to say to you is don't get carried away with this concept of Superman and Super Mario and or whatever, super whatever you want to call it. The reality is it's just fishing. And all of the tactics that I advocate for people are to get that question. How do I catch him? And when I started telling people about using dead baits for carp, their bottom jaw dropped on. When I started telling people about there are certain baits that I use that are for male commons, they couldn't understand it. The reality is that I've done a lot of work over a long time on how to catch male carp, and they are very, very difficult. Black eye was a fish that I caught on a prawn, float fished. Mark Pitchers nearly had a heart attack. He was walking up the footpath, and I was sat on the wire at the footpath, and my rod was in front of me, and my line was laid down on the grass, and I was straight pegging, and that's the type of fishing where your line goes in an arc. And he said, what are you doing? I said, oh, I said, I'm going to catch him on a prawn. You having a laugh? I said, no. So I've seen him. I said, and I've put a few prawns out. I said, and this was August. I said, he's not going to come on a bile approach, mate. I said, this time of year. I said, you're going to have to catch him on something a little bit different. And he was talking to her. Well, you wouldn't believe it. I mean, at one stage, 10 minutes, he was stood there. On about minute nine, there was this massive eruption. Float, of course, eventually goes under. I jumped up, playing it. And I've got black eye on, and the weirdest thing of all, he was 52.6 when we eventually got him in. The weirdest thing of all was the guy who owns the lake, a guy called Dave Ayres, lovely fella, was upstairs having a shave. And anybody, I said shave, by the way, guys, was upstairs having a shave. And anybody who knows the lake, Home Pool, Chad, will know he's got a house right near the lake. And he opened the bathroom window, and he'd got half shaving cream on his face. And I remember him leaning out of the bathroom window, because he was such an elevator view, and saying, Holmesy, you've got him on, don't lose him, for God's sake. Well, I'm all right in bits. I mean, here am I, float fishing, and knowing what fish is on. And, well, I mean, it was just one of those things written in the stars, and Mr. Pitchers netted him, and the rest is history. But, you know, 52.6 on a prawn, 61 on a mixer, 50-pound common on a dead bait. None of them would have been caught on a boilie approach. And this is what I say to people. Now now we understand about zigs and all the rest of it. But the reality is a zig is just a way of catching a fish. Three ways of catching carp, top, middle, or bottom. That's the reality. You know, we've got to make sure that we don't just simply pigeonhole ourselves and it's camping with a bit of fishing thrown in.
Yeah, again, I know, I work with a matchman. And I think there's a lot we can learn from a lot of things they do as well, especially the top, middle, or bottom. They're constantly feeding, and they're experts at getting that competition, that feeding situation.
There's a lot of bullshit, pardon my language, spoken about carp fishing and having to go through extremes to get there. And I fished on a water which had this particular... but a prestigious linear, caravan park linear in Lincolnshire. And my friend David Moore had caught it, and Jason Haywood had caught it, and Lee Walton had caught it. And Lee, he was only his third fish from that lake. And he said to me, he said, I feel a bit, you know, a bit of a cheat, you know, come along and catch. And I said, Lee, at the end of the day, mate, once that indicator goes, the luck stops because you've got to land it. And that particular fish fights like hell. But I had to think of a way to catch the fish. And I caught him twice in a week. I caught him on a Tuesday afternoon and I caught him on a Friday morning. And people said to me, who didn't know, said, why didn't you move off after you'd caught it once? I said, well, I'll go there for the week. I said, but when I caught him on the Friday morning, I felt a bit sad because I'd unlocked the way of catching him. And what I didn't want to do, which is why I sat on it for 2 years, I caught him in July 2012 or 2013. And he was, 5210, I think, 5210. And a bit of a prestigious fish. But what people don't realise is that water was doing 4 or 5 fish a year to some people. And I had 110 fish in a year and a half on there. You know, one time I had a 44 common and a 38 common, and they said there were no big fish in there. I had a 41-pound dark mirror, which is, for those of you who know my Facebook profile page, will see that fish on there. It's just stunning. I had some absolutely stunning fish. So what people should be asking is not, oh, Holmesy caught this very prestigious big fish. They should be saying, how can Holmesy catch so many fish? Because you can only fish for one bite at once. And there's two ways of catching carp. Are you a hunter or are you a trapper? And I grew up trying to be a hunter. And that is basically with my gun in my hand, going out, shooting someone and bringing it home for the table. That's the instinct. Basically, that's the stalking type of thing. That's the little boy on the farm pond with the brandlings chasing him round the lake. That's where that comes from. That's black eye on the prawn. That's the 61 on a floater. That's the 50-pound common with a dead bait. Visual. Now then, that is not predominantly where carp fishing is at. Most of the guys listening out there are trappers. We dig a big hole, put a carcass down there for the bear, and along comes a bear and falls down the hole. Basically, you see it all the time, Friday night, up he rolls, 5 kilos out, sits back, and he waits. That is what some carp fishing is to some people. And what you have to try and do is you have to try and realise that that is probably the most worst type of angling you could ever get. So when you go to a commercial water or you go to any match or match fishing, and I was brought up roach fishing on the River Calder, you feed little and often. Feed little and often. The ultimate thing of feeding little and often is you almost agitate the fish into feeding. Don't get me wrong, if you've got plenty of time, the big spread of bait, rods all on that big spread, and you've got time to wait, fine. But if you're on limited time, you can actually catch bigger fish and better fish by baiting little nothing. And I don't see anglers do it. I see them. And it comes from having no money. I used to make bait, and I'll never forget, I used to make a pound of bait, and I would get 124 to 130 boilies. And I would only be able to fish 2 rods, because I couldn't afford 3 rods. And I remember cutting them out. We used to boilie pulse. Remember the old boilie pulse, Mark? Where you put the boilie in the old plastic thing. And I used to actually count the boilies around the rod. And so I'd sit there after putting me 2 rods out, and I'd count how many baits I'd have. And usually I'd have about 70 baits. And I used to put, I don't know why, but it was my favourite number, I'd put 8 baits around the rod every 3 hours, whether I caught or not. Now, that's not little and often, but in carp fishing terms, for me, it was little and often. And I think that when you actually look at now carp match fishing and you see the likes of Mark Bartlett and his peers, the way these guys are fishing now is just absolutely incredible. And boring old farts like me who believe in stealth and all the rest of it, you can see that on certain waters, that approach, when there are lots and lots of carp, that's the approach to take. That's not my kind of carp fishing. My kind of carp fishing is a lower density water and fish for big fish. But I don't deny how effective that is. But as I'm getting older, I prefer to fish for individual fish, and I prefer to get a buzz for myself out of catching that particular fish, Mark.
I'm exactly the same. I love the individuals, and I'm kind of taking a year out from it this year. I'm just playing around on a big pit with a lot of fish, and I'm not putting 100% effort in. I'm just enjoying being there, to be honest, and not taking it as seriously as in the past. But I'll be back after the year.
Yeah, I'm sure you would, mate. And, you know, life throws various things again at the moment, and the lads who are on the current syndicate that I'm on will be laughing as I say this. There's one particular swim that's been throwing a lot of big fish up, and I can only fish two swims. I can only fish two that are nearest the car park because I'm in need of a knee operation. I used to do martial arts and rugby and football and thought I would always be invincible and young and all the rest of it. But the reality is now, Mark, I need a knee replacement, and I can't walk very far. So it's quite it's been quite a sabbatical for me because I've realised that no longer is it just about catching fish. I have to catch them on my terms, and I've got to bring them to my spot. And what that tends to do is that tends to, I won't say lower your expectations, but I don't want any more to catch other people's fish. I want to try and create something myself. And I always say this to people when they ask me about, can I help them with this tactic and help them with that tactic? I always say, you've got to understand the water that you're on. And if you use a particular tactic that has been used on that water and has thrown up some good fish, then ultimately you will be at the table getting the crumbs. If you can come up with a new tactic that water's not seen before, then you can really, really have it off. And this is why, Mark, and you know it, mate, you've been about a long time as well, you will tend to see the new kid on the block, the new angler in the syndicate, rapes and pillages it for the first 1 or 2 years. And I'll tell you why, because he's got no history to blinker what he needs to do. And this is why, again, contrary to what people think about Mark Holmes, if you see my photo album, you will see 2-3 years, I'm off. Because I know that my third year on there, if I've done well in year 1 and 2, the tactics that I've used to do well in year 1 and 2 will cloud my judgment on the third year. You can stop too long in the water. Now, don't get me wrong, if you're on that water just to have a nice time, not get screwed up about what you can't or what you don't want to catch, if you're into actually developing the fishery almost like carp husbandry, absolutely no problem, stop on there forever. But if you want to try and own your skills and become an all-round carp angler, and if you are a bounty hunter or whatever, I think generally moving about from water to water will make you a better angler all-round, and more importantly, a deeper thinker. And that's one of the things that I try and promote with much of what I say and do, Mark, is to actually get people thinking about how they can develop their tactics based on an idea, a seed I may plant, but how they can then develop that into their own fishing.
Yeah, I've got to say, I do. That's one of those terms I really hate, bounty hunter. I've been called it myself. I prefer the hunter, not the bounty.
Yeah.
But there's one thing, going back to that, the big linear you mentioned, is that fish still around?
Yes, it is, bud. Yeah, it is. It's still alive. I mean, it's one of those. There'll be people now, hastily jotting my mobile number down, saying, "Why are you saying that, Holmes?" The reality is that that water's been otted, and we can talk briefly about otters if you want. But that water's been otted, as many have, and so any water that's been otted, and I don't want to be a doomer in this particular interview, but any water that's been otted, it's just a matter of time, Mark. They are coming, as somebody in the film industry once said, they're coming to a cinema near you. Well, trust me, you ain't got a fence, they're coming to a water near you.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that editorial you did for Advanced Carp for your first, quite bold statements at the time about otters and the potential damage they could be doing.
Oh, they castigated me. Oh, is that again? Doom and Holmes, the Fraser of the carp fishing world and all the rest of it. Doom and gloom. And this is what gets me, you know. I hope I've thrown out the myth that I'm anti-commercial, because I'm not anti-commercial. We briefly touched on that. And I listened to your last carp thing when Simon Crowe, he's a great angler and a lovely, lovely bloke, was on about people being anti-commercial. A lot of people thought that he might have intimated it with me. He wasn't at all, because I've spoken to Simon many, many times over the years, and he knows that it's the laziness, the lazy commercialism that I don't like. But he has said, as many people have said, that you know, there was a time when I spoke too much about otters, and I kind of reined it in because, you know, I don't want to be a doomer. But if you remember, I mooted about 2.5 years ago to start a new carp group, and I got castigated by the great and good in carp fishing, saying he didn't know his arse from an hole in the ground, he's talking rubbish, what does he know about angling politics? I turned up to the PAG meeting, I'm now director on the board there of the PAG, and when my co-directors at the time actually listened to what I'd got to say and understood my history as chairman of Bradford number one, and you'll know, being a Yorkshire lad, that Yorkshire, the North East in particular, along with East Anglia and the South West, were some of the first areas where releases of otters were made, and the effect has been catastrophic. And so I said that we need to do things, and we need to change, and we need to change our mindset, and hopefully that has happened. I think the awareness is there. Recently, with my PAG hat on, we had a guy contact us saying, you know, has there been any progress? Have we done this? Have we done that? I've got to tell you that it's very difficult for me, who can be perceived as the Dennis Skinner type in the Houses of Parliament, suddenly becoming part of the mainstream organisation and not getting heated or jumping up and down. Let me tell you, if you speak to my fellow board members at the PAG, they will tell you, Mark Holmes has lost none of his fervour, of his ability to stamp his feet on the floor and bang his fist on the table. But the reality is, and forgive the colloquialism, you get nowhere pissing outside the tent, you've got to piss inside the tent. And so the important thing is to make sure that if we're going to get anywhere with this otter thing, then we've got to do it in a strategic way that allows us to ask questions of the right people. And without speaking out of turn, basically that is by the legal route. And that legal route is to actually get the people who need to be brought to come in front of us, which in my opinion are people like DEFRA, people like Natural England, and certainly the Environment Agency. Get these people in front of us and say, right, what we want is we want some kind of judicial review. And we want some judicial review so that we can get this on the table. Because we're not looking for a cull, and this is a nonsense what people talk about. You know, you do what you've got to do in life, but the reality is, if I come into your house and I destroy 25 grams worth of possession and you can't do anything about it, that is a human right wrong. Very much like if you let your Alsatian go and it destroys a 15-pound lamb, the farmer has a right to shoot it. Now, that right is not afforded to fish farmers, and that is one of the areas that we've had to look at closely. The right of someone who owns a marketable commodity, which is the carp or fish, and suddenly someone is responsible for taking that living right away from that commodity, away from that guy. Now that cannot happen without recourse, but it's got to be done in such a way that the people who can make change are chastised, rather than simply flying off at a tangent, as happened recently, where a fishery owner tried to take the Environment Agency to court and win a legal case. That ultimately led to a disastrous result for the guy, because he'd not done his due diligence before and put a cast iron case. And so when you go in front of a judge who thinks that fish are just slimy and worth nothing, he doesn't scratch his head and think, what's all this nonsense about? The first line of call has to be bringing the people who understand what the value of these fish are, and more importantly, the people who are responsible for putting together some kind of program that has caused this issue to become the issue that it is, to accountability. Because if you speak to most carp fishermen now, what they will find frustrating, it's not just simply the carcasses turning up, it's the impotence that they feel. And that impotence comes from no one that they can go to and say, why have you done this? Because it's like a veil of secrecy. Well, you know what? We pay millions to the Environment Agency, and one of the Environment Agency's government aims is to take care of fish stocks up and down the country. And to me, and Marco's personal opinion, is that they are negligent and they've not done that, and we have to bring them to task. And as long as I'm involved with the PAG and predation and Bradford number one and all the rest of it, I don't care about protocol and all the rest of it. I have to work within it to get the results that I want. But rest assured, guys, I am out there making sure you will not get away with this, and you will have to be brought to account. And I've got to tell you that that is ultimately what the PAG are working to. And along with Chairman Tim Paisley and Rob Hughes and Chris Burt and all the rest of the guys that are on there, the new blood that we've got in there, I'm telling you, we're going down the right road. One little caveat to that, Mark, is that when I muted that we should have a new CARP group, it was because I realised that there was no political representation for CARP anglers since the demise of the CARP Society. The CARP Society now has become almost just another fishing syndicate, and the BCSG has for years and years said, look, we're not political. That's left, to me, a vacuum. And the reality is that I'm of an age where I had to feel bad about being a carp angler. I was at the behest of other certain types of angling, and carp anglers, we had to fight for two rods, we had to fight for night fishing, we had to fight for a third rod. We always had to fight. You know what? I'm not going to make any apologies anymore, because more than 55% of angling up and down this country is carp related. So no longer are carp anglers the poor relations at the table. And what carp anglers now need is we need political representation of our own to get our point across. And I'm not going to steal anybody's thunder or spike anybody's guns, but the reality is that watch this space, guys, and in the next month you will see a public announcement which will A, hope to fill that vacuum that I've spoken about, and B, some real genuine movements from the PAG. And those of you who kind of get it, why would the PAG now be looking at actively fundraising events? We have meetings every month. What for? We don't want to raise funds for tea and sandwiches. We want to raise funds for something that we've got lined up. And we've got some very, very high people involved. That's going to cost money, but the reality is we've gone down this road and we're going to see it to its conclusion. And it took us a long time to put together one of the most comprehensive pieces of literature you will ever see on predation, and that was called The Big Picture, and it was collated by Tim Paisley, but there's an awful lot of people that put their facts and figures in there. Yours truly did the financial aspect, which I got castigated for, but I put down what the value of fish we'd lost in Yorkshire on a snapshot of waters. Well, that was to put a yardstick in the sand. The reality is now is that we gave the angling authorities and all the people involved who were supposedly the great and good who were going to help angling, we gave them 12 months to try and sort that out and push that forward. We don't feel that's been pushed the way it is. So what we're doing now is we're not going to be as conciliatory as we've been in the past. We're going to now get on the front foot and start moving it forward. And like I said, within the next month, 2 months, you will suddenly get a lot of people going, aha, that's what they've been doing.
I'm looking forward to this announcement now, and I've got to be honest, you've answered just about every question I've got on the predation with that last lot. But so how can your average angler like me support the PAG then? What can we do? Get our weight behind you?
Well, the reality is that first of all, which I just find absolutely incredible, is there's still denial from, I don't want to get personal, but you know what, sod it, I will get personal. I read an article in Carpology by a guy who obviously works in the public sector. I think he worked for Natural England or something. And he was trying to come up with an argument that the otter situation was very complex and it wasn't so straightforward. And, you know, it's not just, it's a common issue and blah, 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 blah. But basically he was making excuses for what quite clearly is a terrible situation where otters have been ripping carp, historical things, to pieces for far too long. And I just felt like ringing up Joe Wright, the editor, and saying, can you get this guy's mobile number, and I'll get him to come over to my fishery, and we'll have a chat about this. It's almost like some anglers are in denial. We have to stop that. We have to stop our own anglers thinking two things. One, that this is a problem that's going to go away, because it isn't. And one thing which I will say, and I'm going to be a northerner now, is that if what would have happened in the north would have happened in the Corn Valley, I tell you this, there would have been far, far more jumping up and down than there has been. But the reality is that this was done in the backwaters of carp fishing, when they're now going to be in these great and good areas of carp fishing, then we'll see people jumping up and down. So the first thing people have to do is they have to realise that this is a problem that needs dealing with. It's not going to be nature that balances this out, because our opponents are not playing the game that they're saying. They are saying that there were no releases of otters since 1999. Hogwash, absolute tosh. They're still being released illegally, and no one will admit to that, and we need to make sure that people understand that point. And the second thing, and I can't nail this down enough, if I hear anybody tell me again that if we are too vociferous about the otter problem, angling will be in a real bad state because the general public will try and ban it, you're having a laugh. Currently, angling employs something like 37,000 people in this country and generates 3 billion. Yeah, not million, 3 billion in revenue. Who in their right mind, and there's 3 million of us, who in their right mind would ban that? So you know what? We need to grow a pair as anglers and realise that we have to stand up for what we believe in. And I'm no longer going to feel bad about putting my hand in the air and saying, you know what? You want indigenous species in this country. I tell you what, I'll release wolves. And when it rips your poodle's throat out, which is not indigenous to this country, what would you think? Because that's the kind of rhetoric nonsense that these a-holes are coming out with.
Yeah, you've kind of got me all fired up on the otter issue there.
I hope that the listeners out there can realise that the old Mark Holmes that some of them hated and some of them loved is still the same guy. He's still as passionate about this. That passion's not gone away. It's a bit more controlled. It's a little bit like the old joke, isn't it, about two bulls in a field. One of them's 10 years old and one of them's 2 years old. And they're having a conversation and all the cows are down the bottom and they're all in season. So the young bull of 2 years old says, come on, let's get moving, let's get down there. And the older bull says, hang on a minute, mate, let's walk down slowly, then we've got more energy left to do the deed. And that, ultimately, is the difference between Mark Holmes of 10 years ago and Mark Holmes of today.
Yeah, I can certainly tell, just listening to you there, you've certainly got that passion and fire on the otter issue. And I'll be honest, when it first surfaced, I'll hold my hand up. I did kind of think, yeah, whatever, I'll bury my end as a sand in the touch till... Well, my second biggest fish to this day was eaten by an otter. Then it's like, ooh, it can happen anywhere. It can happen to fisheries I know.
It is, Mark, and it's a NIMBY syndrome. You know, it's not in my backyard. You know, and we all suffer from that. We all suffer from that. But the reality is that they are now so widespread. Rob Hughes and I went to a conference nearly two years ago now, Edinburgh, which was the otter conference. And we went up there in a really hostile situation that was full of otter enthusiasts and all the rest of it. And they were trying to, when we asked clearly what are the number of otters in the British Isles, they said they didn't know. And when I rounded on them and said, well, hang on a minute, you knew in the late 70s that the otter population was X and almost wiped out. And how did you know that? He said, well, we used a certain analogy, and that's the analogy that we used to get that number. I said, right, can I be presumptuous? I take it that that analogy that you use now, there's thousands and thousands. And he said, yeah. I said, so basically what you're telling me is that when something goes for you, you'll use that analogy to get what you want, which is a protectionist and reintroduction program. But when it becomes that they're overrun and they're actually killing each other, as well as bird life and all the rest of it, you don't want to use that analogy. So where I come from, that's hypocrisy. Poor old Rob Hughes was dragging me down under the table at the time. But that's the point that I made, because these things, and anybody who's been on the waters that are otters will know exactly what I said, what I'm just going to say. They kill swans, they kill Canadian geese, they kill ducks, they kill coots, they kill moorings. They kill every living thing on your lake. And I can go on a lake and I can tell within a couple of hours if that water's been ottered. Nothing to do with finding carcasses of carp, but I can tell by the other wildlife that is no longer on there. So don't talk to me, Mr. Environmentalist, I'll release them because it's doing something for the environment. It's a nonsense. What anglers are looking for is an ecosystem that works. And I don't want anybody to patronise anglers and tell us that we don't know about the environment that we live in, because if it wouldn't have been for angling, and carp angling in particular, the development of nature, the development of the waterside code, all of these buzzwords, the development of bird life, all of these things would have been in danger. We are bastions of the countryside, and now they want to turn us into bastards of the countryside, and I'm not having it.
Yeah, I'm quite blown away taking all this in. Yeah, I've obviously known about the otter situation, and I'm glad to hear from you, well, obviously representative of the PAG, that things are actually happening, and that announcement you're talking about, I'm looking forward to it. Will that appear on Facebook and other platforms?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously Tim Paisley is the chairman, and obviously it comes through our press officer and comes through Tim, and it has to be done in such a way that, you know, it's done correctly, because you get people, as there'll be people pulling to bits things I've said today, swearing and all the rest of it. But, you know, the reality is that when you go out into print, it's there in black and white. And so it's got to be done correctly, and it's got to be done in such a way that it's not something that's going to come back and bite angling and work against angling. So Tim will be making an announcement along with Rob Hughes as to where we are and what we're doing. But the reality is that we're looking for trade support, and that trade support comes from all the guys who are listening to this on an individual basis. They can put pressure. They can put pressure on there imperceptibly, nice and slowly, or they can put pressure on there strongly by ringing them up saying, why don't you support the PAG? All of that is basically what we're looking for. But if anybody has any questions, you know my Facebook, I do get a lot of questions, and I will get around to answering them, but anybody can contact me at any time. I'm no shrinking violet. If I don't know the answer, I'll tell them I don't know the answer. But if I do know the answer, I'll give it to them in such a way that they're able to understand it, Matt.
Okay, we've been going for over an hour now, so I think it's time to call it quits on that note. But just as a final thing, what would you say to the just average angler, frustrated with the otters, feels helpless, like you say? There is hope.
Yeah, there is hope. I would think that there has to be a certain degree of reality to what's going to happen. One thing I would say to people is that if you want to keep catching big fish and you want to target big fish, then ultimately you need to be looking at a water that's fenced. If you are not, then you are fishing with a roll of the dice. I've done it in the past where I fish big waters, I fish for ghosts, and I've proved to myself that there are big fish in there. Because of the spread of the otter, now I wouldn't do that. I'd want to see them before I caught them. So carp fishing will survive, and it will always survive, because there is a need there. But unfortunately, at the moment, it's looking as though the halcyon days of strolling through the woods and coming across big fish in nature reserves and the wild and wonderful outbacks of England are a thing of the past, Mark. We've got to try and make sure that we don't just lose history, but we redefine it, mate.
Yep, and that's a great note to end. Thanks a lot, Mark Holmes, for coming on the Carpcast.
Absolute pleasure, Mark. You take care. I hope this is a roaring success for you and Jamie, mate.
All right, thanks a lot, pal.
Cheers, bud. See you later on.
Big thank you to Mark Holmes, and thank you to Mark Watson for doing the interview. I was out of the room on that one and thought we'd better let Mark take the reins for one. Interesting guy, isn't he? Mark's got
It was very very enjoyable, and to be honest, quite an easy interview, as I'm sure everyone can tell. I barely said a word compared to Mark, but when he was on a flow, it's just let him go. He's I love the otters and the update on the predation action group as well. It's something something we all need to get behind, because it is a threat to carp fishing.
Yep. And just to mention, we were talking about Euro Aqua on the, it's on the net bit at the start of the show. While the show is being recorded, it's done, as I predicted at the start, it's done another £100. Stephen Weir, who is the guy that's put me on to Euro Aqua, he's the guy that, you know, I started seeing the pictures on Facebook, and he seems to be running a lot of the trips. He had some monster sessions last year. He had a couple, didn't he? He's had, I believe it's the 94 pounder that the Manchester guy had, a brace of 90s that made national news Septemberish last year. I believe it's the 94 that he had. That Stephen Weir's just had at £104, different fish to the 105 that was out the other day. So that's 200 pounders. And I've seen the picture of it. The pictures are all over Facebook. It does look like it's going to explode.
Yeah, what else is in there?
Well, you know, we had 290s that day, and it's put on £10 since November, since September, and what are we in now? June, just. That lake is going to be ridiculous, you know. As I said, it's, you know, the owner's piling the bait in there constantly. Them fish ain't getting smaller. But, I mean, yeah, it does look like it's going to burst, this one.
It's kind of like an interesting mad scientist experiment to see how big it can get the carp.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anywhere else is going to come close. I mean, how can you take fish of that calibre, put them in a lake, have them fish for all year, and literally tons of bait going in constantly, you know, being fed? It is, an experiment. You know, them, and I think there's so many fish in there, there is competition for food. So it's not like, I know Nashi on his lakes was trying to do something similar by feeding them and not fishing for them, so that they're not scared of eating. Because the problem comes, you know, if they know they're going to get caught, there's a chance of them getting caught, they don't eat quite what maybe they want to. But I think when you've got a decent amount of fish in the lake and there's competition for food and they're obviously big hungry fish, it kind of counteracts you know, the danger side of it, because they got to eat, and there's competition there, you know, so many fish in one lake, so they're going to keep eating. It's an interesting thing to follow it. I mean, as I said at the start of the show, there could be 400 or 500 pounders in there by the back end of the year. I mean, I totally go with that now. You know, it's just done two in a week, so.
Wow, do you take you've got to have a special sort of landing net if you latch onto one of those. As usual, 42 inches ain't going to be big enough.
You don't want to be lifting it out of the water, do you? Like by the pole. You ever had somebody on a lake like, I'll net the fish for you, you know, and you're like, you don't really want to be rude and say, no, I'll do it myself.
I have been rude. I've said no. I've done the same with people with, I've done self-tapes when other people have been around, because, well, I know I can do self-tapes to a pretty good standard, and you don't know everybody, so.
No, and I've had people in me landing there, and, you know, they've got it in the net, and then they've just tried lifting the pole up, and it's like a banana in the middle. And
that's one way to snap it.
I'm just like, no, don't live in the water. Imagine doing that with a 105-pounder.
Oh, you're not doing it. You're breaking your net.
Anyway, let's move on. Let's wrap this up, because it's been a long one again, this. Worth a look. So, I'm going to go first with the worth a look, because it ties into something we said in, was it show number one or show number two? We were joking about live streaming from the bank. You know, we're looking at technology and fishing and how things are moving forward, and maybe, you know, we can live stream from the bank. Well, it's happened, or certainly the facility to make it happen is now out there. There's an app for your phone. It's done by Twitter. It links to your Twitter account, and it's called Periscope. The Carpcast now has a Periscope linked to its Twitter account. I've got my own one. If you don't follow me on Twitter, it's at Dustitute, Dustitute. I'm sure if you search Jamie Klosick, you'll also find my Twitter. It's a live streaming app that streams directly from your phone. It does it in real time, and you can chat while it's streaming. And you can also you can all, it saves the videos at the end of the stream as well, so even if you miss it live, you'll get a notification on your phone as soon as if I go live, Carpcast or anyone you follow, you get a little whistle on your phone and it tells you, and you can literally just swipe it and you're watching us live. So I intend to do some streaming. I'm in Vegas next week, a couple of days after this show goes out, so the only streaming that will be done might be from a poker tournament, but I will be playing with it and having a mess if I've got a decent Wi-Fi over there in the casinos. And I'm sure you'll be having a go, Mark, on the Carpcast.
Oh, certainly will. I've got the Carpcast one attached to my phone, and as long as I've got a strong enough strength on the bank, I will I'll be talking from the bank, having a bit of an exchange with anyone who's tuned in. Also, you can do the thing if you catch a fish, a big if at the minute for us both, innit? But, you know, you can have it in the retainer for 5 minutes, notify people we've got one on the bank and show them the fish live.
Can you imagine, like, you know, if everybody gets onto this, you imagine an iconic fish gets caught. I can't think of one currently, but let's say, I don't know, the British record gets caught, the big one from Wasing. The parrot, is it? Let's say that gets caught, and you know, obviously, while it's in the retainer, you're setting all the cameras up and stuff, and people to photograph it. Instead of somebody just taking a normal video of your phone, they, you know, you set the Periscope app up, and they're live streaming it as it happens from the bank. Everybody, you're at work, you're at home, whatever, fishing yourself.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to going into that one, and also seeing what other people come up with on the Periscope.
Yeah, be interesting if a few anglers get onto it. You know, live as it happens, stories from, you know, big fish get caught, somebody videos it, you know, or live streams it instead of videoing the capture. You know, people can watch it there and then. You know, imagine a British record gets caught and it's being streamed as it happens. You know, you're at work, you get a notification, and you know, you can actually watch the weighing go down. You can watch the pictures being taught, you can kind of share in the moment as it's happening. So I hope other anglers, you know, especially the significant ones, your Dave Lanes and people that are videoing and stuff all the time, I hope they get onto it.
Yeah, I'm sure they will. Now, we're going to carry on with the next Worth a Look, because we've really been spoilt with the YouTube goodies at the minute.
Yep. New Fox DVD is out on YouTube.
It is. I think it's been available in the shops for quite a while as a free DVD, but it's now on YouTube and is just shy of 4 hours long.
Yep, Chili and Tom Maker, Mark Bartlett, Lewis Porter, Steve Spurgeon, Scott Day, Rob Hughes, Mark Pictures. Like I say, we've spoke about the DVD before. Still not watched it yet. Now it's up on YouTube. I think I'll be taking a look.
Yep, I have watched it, and I can say my favourite two bits of it are our two previous guests that are in that list. The Mark Pictures Challenge, which I'm not going to spoil it for anyone, but he's got to catch carp from five different venues, beginning with the letters C-A-R-P-Y.
That's a great idea.
So he has to travel around and, watch it and see how he does. And the next one, Rob Hughes goes out, does his underwater stuff with Mark Bartlett, and you know, I'm really enjoying, I think I've got on late to watching Rob Hughes and reading about his underwater exploits, but I'm really enjoying this. And in this one, Mark Barley fishes what we'd call Elstow style, with the three rods on very, very tight on one spot.
Oh yeah, that's interesting. See it from the underwater point of view.
Yeah, I'll let you watch it, I don't want to spoil it, but it's interesting to see what's happened to the spot the next day.
Interesting. I mean, That style of fishing has been improved with the wrapping system now. I mean, I think when we used to do it, and how I used to do it was to put a marker out there, then I'd cast three rods as close to the marker as I could, and just put them down on the rest wherever I think they landed. You know, if that one landed left of the first one, it went on the left-hand side. If the other one landed in the middle, I'd move the middle one over and, you know, put the rod in place. I'd get them as tight as I could, but when you're casting 80, 90 yards or maybe further, the depth perception of casting at a marker float is very deceiving. So I know from when I've done underwater stuff with Rob, like if one bait is like 2 yards further out than the other one, which is extremely easy to do. I mean, I've watched people from the side that think they're casting level with the marker float and the three rod lengths behind it, and they don't know, you know, if it's been a mate, I've rung them and told them, certainly, how far do you think you are close to your marker float? And they're like, oh yeah, it landed about a rod length behind. I'm like, it wasn't, it was three rod lengths behind. I'm side onto it, so I can see. And it's very hard when you're at kind of, you know, your eye light level is five and a half foot, 6 foot above water level, and you're casting 90 yards out. It's extremely deceiving. But with the wrapping system now, obviously you can wrap it to an exact amount. So I would do the same thing now. Wherever the first rod went, if I thought it landed on the spot near the marker, I'd wrap that out, clip it, and do the other two rods to exactly the same distance. Because if you don't, if one rod's a rod length, two rod lengths further than the others, then that line is running through the swim, usually off the ground, which is making the other two rods virtually useless. And how many times have you had three rods on the spot and it's only one rod that keeps going? I would argue that that's probably the furthest rod out, because you're kind of cutting off the other two with one of the rods.
Yeah, there's that. Or is it that the only one that's on the real spot and the other two have landed shy of it?
Well, subject for another time. We can go into spots within spots, which is something I've spoke about loads over the years. And I remember having in-depth chats with Gary Bayes about the spots within spots. This has been a long one, this, so we can have a go at another time on that one, but mark that down.
Yeah, definitely. With so many things that we talk about on this carp cast, where we think, we'll come back to that. And I think the moon phases was definitely one that we've covered. Yeah. So, but also, Nash have released another film for YouTube.
Worth a look.
This is the box set part 2, film 1. So I'm assuming there will be more. And this is The Governor, Kev Nash. It's 52 minutes. And I watched this one. Admittedly, I watched it while I was potting around doing other stuff. And then after about 5 minutes, I just put things down and just watched it.
But yes,
it's just Kevin fishing. And basically explaining how he's asked all these questions via his Facebook page and other mediums, and he's answered them all via this video, DVD. Well, not all of them, but he claims his 7 golden rules, which you're going to have to watch it to find them out, because I'm not going to tell you.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. But it's good. It's there's a lot of stunning fish as well. And it's more instructional, technical, without going too deep, too mind-blowing. You know, it's going to benefit anybody who watches it. Anglers of all levels.
Yep, it's definitely worth a look.
Worth a look.
Shall we wrap this one up now? Because I've got Vegas to pack for. Hopefully do some periscoping while I'm there. This will be out on Friday, and I should be back, hopefully, Rich, by the time we do the next Carpcast.
Well, if you do come back, Rich, the Carpcast could do with a lot of investment.
Yeah. I'm glad you said the Carpcast and not you. So.
Oh, I've always needed investment.
Cool.
I've given up.
All right. Until next time, we'll see you then.
Yeah. See you again.